Two Designers Walk Into a Bar is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network.
For more information about our show or to discover more podcasts you'll enjoy, visit evergreenpodcasts.com.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
I want to come up with a Charles Manson energy drink and call it Helter Seltzer.
Oh my gosh, that's brilliant. Aren't you amazed that Brian Setzer hasn't done a Setzer Seltzer yet?
Yeah, well, he's too busy rounding up stray cats.
Oh, I see what you did there.
I got a million Bon Mots.
Yeah, I got a million of them.
Just ask me, I'll share them all with you. Hey everyone, it's Elliot.
And Todd. Welcome to Two Designers Walk Into a Bar, an ongoing conversation about pop culture and iconic design.
From the punkish late 70s into the plastic early 80s, the new wave movement affected design, fine art, movies, and of course, music.
This season, we're unpacking how it was synthesized.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yep. And how it came to have amazing effects on all things 80s and into pop culture today.
So ask your favorite Top Gun cocktail slinger to whip up some B-52s, point out your Galaga High score to the other bar patrons,
and join us as we pogo back into the bar. I love that. I mean, you did that really. You didn't trip over Top Gun cocktail slinger. I love that.
Todd, you're dealing with a professional.
I quickly forget sometimes.
That makes two of us. Okay, everybody. So here we are back in the bar. And Todd, yep. I am looking around and there is a super funky decor happening right now.
Yep. Day-glow colors, checkerboards, weird angles.
It is our new season, so I guess we have to celebrate that.
That's right, because we're talking about the period of New Wave, and specifically New Wave from the late 70s to the 80s, into the early 80s, I should say. So let me ask you a question, Elliot. What do you think of when you think of the early 80s?
Oh, man. Todd, how much time do you have?
It's not me, dude. The listener can shut off anytime. So go for it.
They're probably gone by now. They just swung in for a cheap PBR and they're out. But for those of you who haven't yet left the bar, I would say bold colors, funky haircuts, mm-hmm. right? The Cold War mm-hmm. and the Cola Wars. Video games and MTV, right? Mm-hmm. Japanese mm-hmm. electronics, European fashion. So many iconic
Yeah.
music and movies, you know, so albums, musicians, movies, soundtracks, right? Movie soundtracks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really transitional decade culturally, I think. And for me personally, it spans the time in my life when I was in the first through the 11th grades. So really, really formative years, right?
Yeah.
I am proud to say I am firmly an 80s kid.
Yes. Yes, you are. And I kind of am, too, although I was a little more closer to adulthood than you are. So I got to.
Well, what happened? Because by the time I met you, I mean.
I had regressed. I had regressed.
which is one of the things I love about you, Todd.
I know. Yeah. And by the way, when I first met you, you had quite the funky haircut.
I did, but it wasn't Flock of Seagulls funky.
No. It was kind of like you had put the 80s to rest. But kind of not.
Well, thank you, I think.
All right. Well, wait a minute. This podcast is not about haircuts. It's about, we're doing this one about New Wave. So let me tell you something.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I thought this was our other secret podcast about, where we talk to hairstylists.
Yeah, that would be fun too. But You probably know this. The term New Wave, it's been applied to many, many global artistic movements. But what we're talking about is that period of late 70s, early 80s, Vans sneakers, Swatch watches, members only jackets, parachute pants, synthesizers, asymmetrical haircuts.
Oh yeah, and the mall claw. Let me see if I can find my can of hair mousse.
Okay. All right, what's a mall claw, Elliot?
You don't know the mall claw?
No, dude.
Girls, when they would have their hair, you know, their bangs, they would always tease their bangs kind of in this little poof. And so make a claw sort of form with your hand, just kind of like, you know, like a scary hand, like in a horror movie poster. But then just plaster that hand, like put the back of it against your forehead. That's the mall claw, baby. Come on. Come on. Get with
the program. So it's like a hair tiara then?
Sort of, but it's lower than that. It's sort of like if you wore a tiara as a headband while you were roller skating. or, you know, going into like, I don't know, what's a good 80s store? Spencer Gifts.
yeah. That's a good one. Chess King.
Yeah, but that was for guys. That wasn't for girls.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
The Gap. So, you know, you go into the Gap, you'd have your mall claw.
Okay. I got a really good picture now. Totally moosed up. Good deal. And as we think about it, I think there are three factors that led to the origins of New Wave. And let me deal those to you.
Please, unpack these because I'm really curious about this.
All right. First of all, because again, I was kind of an adult, so I know stuff like this.
Uh-huh.
So first, awareness of global and political and economic uncertainty.
Oh, gosh. Great. This is your master's thesis all over again.
Here it goes. Yeah. Secondly, a big one. Technological advances.
Sure. We just talked about that a little bit ago. Like I was saying, all the Japanese electronics.
Yep. And lastly, the DIY ethos. What does that mean? We're going to get into it a little bit.
All right. Let's go, man.
All right. So we're mainly talking about the new wave that started in the UK and the US, and specifically London and New York City. And I'd say if New Wave was a style and an attitude, then music was the delivery device. It's how we experienced that style and attitude, right?
Oh, gosh. I mean, as we were talking about just a minute ago, music has always been the carrier and sort of the barometer of pop culture, I think, right? I mean, even though we call this podcast Two Designers Walk Into a Bar, we talk a lot about music, as our listeners know. So from punk to bop jazz of the Beats to pop to Studio 54 disco. So our bar has a very, very large jukebox.
Yes, it does. And we're thankful for that. We love it. And we also love to put a pin and a date on our podcast so we get a starting point. And the date we're going to pin today is October 28th, 1977. And that's the day the Sex Pistols' debut, Nevermind the Bollocks, was released. The Sex Pistols were already media darlings by then.
You could say that, or you could say pariahs, really, depending on your point of view, right?
Yeah, good point. By the way, at the time, they were on their third record company in just 6 months and had their first, you'll like this part even better, their first 9 U.S. tour dates coming up. But they would only play 5 of those dates in 12 days and then break up shortly after that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so it's sort of amazing that people knew who they were at all with that type of track record. All right, so anyway, so you're bringing up the Sex Pistols, talked about London, talked about New York. So I bet you're going to tie this together for us, right? You're going to weave your tapestry of, I don't know, nostalgia or culture with a walk down the musical memory lane, right? Because the Sex Pistols, last time I checked, I was looking in my file cabinet while you were just talking, and the Sex Pistols are not filed under New Wave. I couldn't find them in that folder.
Nope, not at all. Obviously, the Sex Pistols were punk, yet tons of different types of music peaked in 1977. I'm super lucky, as I said. I was kind of a young teen in 1977, and I got to experience this perfect storm of music. So if you went to a club then, which, by the way, you shouldn't do if you're 13 kids.
Unless you're Brooke Shields, right?
Well, that's right. That's right.
If you go back and listen to our Studio 54 episode.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. But if you went to a club then, you would hear hard rock, funk, pop, R&B, and punk all rolled into one night. It was the peak time of many, many musical genres. And if you happened to be in the South Bronx attending one of Africa Bambaataa's block parties, you were witnessing the birth of hip-hop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, and if you went further downtown to CBGB in the Bowery, you were witnessing the birth of New Wave predecessors.
Okay, so I have a pretty good memory. We're talking about 1977. Wasn't this the same year that Studio 54 opened?
It was. You do have a good memory. So the Bee Gees, they appeared on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. And as a matter of fact, when I talk about the sort of the culmination of music, three of the top 10 best-selling albums of all time were released in 1977. So one-third of the top.
I want to know what these are. Okay, because okay. Nothing. Well, you said Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, so Saturday Night Fever.
Okay.
Got that one.
Got it. Okay.
Because disco was hot.
Yeah.
Rumors by Fleetwood
Mac.
Okay,
I could see that. Yeah, sure. That's perennial favorite.
Yep. And then this one's a little bit of an outlier, but Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell. Not very punk, right?
No. I mean, it's kind of funny. I regard that album as like, is it a real album, right? Or is it like a come, like, is it a put on? Like, is it, you know, is it sort of Spinal Tap-ish? Like, I mean, to this day, I'm really not sure, to be honest with you.
All right. Well, let's shelve that, and we'll get to an episode of that one day, because I think there's a lot to unpack in that one.
Oh, gosh, obviously. Yeah. Sorry, folks. I didn't mean to get us off track.
That's okay. So back to the Sex Pistols, because I mentioned the influence of that date of the album release. And love them or not, the, I'm doing air quotes, idea of the Sex Pistols sparked a fire that excited fans and future bands and record companies. Bands no longer had to be Fleetwood Mac to be successful.
True, true. Okay, and going back to your air quotes for a second, you used the word idea because the Sex Pistols were like this sort of band pulled together by London shop owner Malcolm McLaren, and they were they were kind of an anti-band, really, when you think about what was happening in music at the time, right?
Right, right. You're exactly right. And that's what was so inspirational for other punk bands that then led to New Wave. That made everyone rethink music and style. But okay, let's just dig into a bit of the 1977 album debuts, just so we can hear like who was putting out their first album then, see if any of them have hung around. So I already mentioned Never Mind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols. They were super media famous before the album even came out. As a matter of fact, it was, like I said, they broke up shortly after that in 1977. And this is how that idea caught so much fire. Iggy Pop released three albums in 1977.
Yep, Iggy from Detroit. Okay, so he was pretty busy.
Yeah, Talking Heads 77. Came out then.
Okay.
The Clash released The Clash, their first album. Elvis Costello, My Aim Is True, first album. Marquee Moon by Television.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. Well, I mentioned Bat Out of Hell. That goes a little outlier here, but that was a debut.
Okay.
Not bad sales for your debut, anyway.
No.
In the City by The Jam.
Sure.
Damn, Damn, Damned by, can you guess the band?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say The Damned.
Yeah, there you go. Good job. And Cheap Trick released Cheap Trick. And they also released a second album that year. And Motorhead. We love Motorhead, don't we?
Yeah.
Released their debut.
So a lot of eponymous albums. Like I guess they exhausted so much creativity with the music itself, they couldn't come up with album names.
Well, that was kind of the tradition.
No, I know.
Then.
I'm teasing.
Oh, okay.
Lemmy's Ghost, please don't come after me.
I thought you were so serious. Yeah, he will come after you from the grave.
Well, Todd, I'm as serious as Meatloaf is. How about that? Take that for what it's worth.
All right, we'll leave that right here on the table with us. As a matter of fact, 1977 was the peak year vinyl sales in the United States. Almost 350 million albums were sold, and sales started declining year over year until about 2010, when hobbyists rediscovered vinyl, and that created a slight but steady growing market since then.
Sure.
But for all intents and purposes, 77 was the peak vinyl year because, as you know, cassettes became popular, CDs became popular, so
yep.
the record went away.
Yep.
But here's something, though. In addition to the debuts, several bands signed their first record contracts. Remember, that idea, the punk idea, caught fire. Bands like The Cars, Devo, love Devo, The Police. So several big things converged that sparked this new way of creativity. Questioning the old expected artistic expressions and changing the status quo and making the new more mainstream. Let's unpack that.
Yeah, so our listeners know we're fans of punk. As I mentioned earlier, all the music we've talked about. New Wave was an offshoot of punk, right?
Right.
I mean, so we've talked about the Velvet Underground. So didn't this start with bands like them or Television, you mentioned mm-hmm. a minute ago, mm-hmm. or Iggy's neighbors from Detroit, MC5, right? You know, the Motor City Five. So how did the rawness and chaos of punk transform into this more melodic and synthetic form of music called New Wave? I mean, because I get the DIY ethos, but if you put the two types of music next to one another, you know, it would be an awkward transition, I think. It's not like it's a smooth blend, right?
Right, right. Of course. Great question. Both of those movements, I would say from 77 to 79, both were rebellions against the establishment. They were bored with the traditional, bloated, overproduced, and overexposed music of rock, pop, disco, and overexposed, overproduced fashion. Think about Malcolm McLaren's shop that you mentioned, Sex.
Right, like, right.
They weren't traditional at all.
No. I mean, I would, you know, that shop was as much of an art project, I think, as it was a retail store. Very Warhol-like, right? Like, very similar.
Right, exactly.
The art of business.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, let's play a game here. I just read a few words representing what punk and new wave were rebelling against. Bloated, overexposed, overproduced, boring. If we were to give those qualities to an entertainer of the time, who do you think that would be?
I mean, the first person to pop into my head is Elvis.
Bingo. Right. And when did Elvis die? August of 1977.
Yeah.
How about that?
He left the building for the last time, Todd.
Right. So don't you think that added a little fuel to the anti-establishment fire? It's like the king is gone. And
literally.
All those things and literally that represented bloated, you know, music and person too. Not that we hate Elvis, love Elvis, but that was a signal, right?
Yep.
And so punk, as we know it, they leaned into the DIY ethos from the 50s and 60s. It was more raw. And if punks were the cool ne'er-do-wells styled in leather and foppish hair, then New Wave evolved into its younger, safer, can we say nerdier little brother. It was considered the lighter, more melodic broadening of punk. And the term New Wave, which most credit Seymour Stein of Sire Records.
Yeah, he at the time was definitely a mover and a shaker in the industry.
Oh, yeah,
in
he
general.
Was totally
very
into
influential,
this.
Very influential, yeah.
Totally into this. And he came up with that term because he was afraid that there was so much negativity around the term punk. So he sanitized punk because the media, they were starting to portray punk groups as violent and unruly, and eventually sort of developed a stigma, especially in the United States. And he thought that made the music virtually unmarketable.
Right. Well, if it's the soundtrack to the rebellion, like what stores want to, I mean, you might have the select independent stores, but Kmart is never going to get excited to put records to get a bunch of punks in there, right? So, okay, so what were these musicians, whether it be punk or new wave, whatever, what were they rebelling against exactly?
Great question, because as you know, culture breeds the art from it. And in 1977 through 79, the OPEC crisis that triggered the highest inflation and unemployment rates since the beginning of World War II in the UK.
So the art, what you're talking about for those, you know, when you say the OPEC, there was an oil shortage and people were lining
right.
up at the gas stations with their cars because there was all this gas rationing.
Right, right. And that was a real thing. And people were hot about it because they had to wait in line for hours to get a small ration of gas. So that affected the U.S. as well as the U.K., but it did trigger a major gigantic spike of inflation and unemployment in the UK. And the US, as I said, they were facing high inflation rates knocking on the door of that 1980s recession. And, you know, let's not forget about New York City in 1977. There was that was a hot mess, literally.
Yeah, literally.
The city was broke. Crime was rampant because they had laid off first responders and police. There was a super contentious mayoral race going on. The Son of Sam, like a serial killer, was loose in New York City and causing a lot of terror. And let's not forget the big blackout of 1977 all the looting and fires.
Yeah.
Like literally New York was on fire.
Yeah. It truly was. And like you said earlier, this was... You know, you think about the Bronx, for example, and how, I mean, that was no man's land at the time. And
that
that still birthed hip hop.
Yeah. Yeah. There was great art that came out of it.
Yeah. So that's what I was about to say. Like all this, you know, to your point a second ago, all this badness is what always is sort of this crucible that creates amazing art. Right. So, there's always something good that comes out of the bad.
Yeah, yeah. Let me mention real quick that documentary that you recommended to me, and we should post a link to it.
Oh, absolutely.
On the episode page.
Yeah.
It was called NYC 77.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was originally produced, I think, by VH1, actually.
Oh, yeah. And I love the title. It was The Coolest Year in Hell. So.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and it you're exactly right. The reason I recommended it to you was because... I mean, it was really, but I didn't even know we were doing this podcast episode. I had just kind of bird dogged this and said, hey, this is super cool. I think you'll dig this. And they do an exceptional job talking about New York specifically and what was going on in all of the different subcultures that we've talked about, hip hop, disco, all of it.
Yes. And it showed me New York City was really, really a hot spot for the arts then that would birth a lot of other musical directions, including New Wave. And that was one factor, right? But let's think about what people were exposed to. There was this growing global awareness in the world. Not only were we treated to nightly news of, you know, political and economic uncertainty around the world. You remember Ayatollah Khomeini, right?
Yep.
At the same time, musicians were being turned on to exotic musical rhythms, instruments, and beats from all over the place.
Yep.
So before, everything in pop music had been that sort of steady four on the floor blues based.
Right. So we're moving away from the basic blues based music, and New Wave is sort of embracing more of this global influence, I guess.
Yeah. And so that all folds in to the New Wave culture of questioning the traditional, right? And New Wave was, as a scene, it was developing to be stylistically diverse. And some late 70s New Wave artists like Blondie, XTC, Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, they appropriated the raw punk energy. And then there started to be these offshoots of more synthesizer bands like Human League, Devo, Depeche Mode, etc. They embraced synthesizers and sort of African funk rhythms. But still others, like we know the Talking Heads, Adam and the Ants, Bow Wow Wow, they incorporated reggae and West African rhythmic concepts to traditional rock music. So there starts to be this playful postmodern quality that's going on. It's a mixture of both the old and the new blending together.
Todd, you're exactly right. I mean, there is just so much to talk about. And, you know, speaking of mixing the old and the new, why don't you get your old self up and get me a fresh new drink?
I see what you did there. Okay. We'll be right back, folks.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hi, we want to take a moment to mention that if you're enjoying this episode, we have an archive of topics ranging from the Olympics to movie posters.
Think Ghostbusters.
Iconic images.
Think Bigfoot.
Punk music.
The Ramones.
Saturday morning cartoons.
The Pink Panther.
And failed products like OK Soda. Visit our website at twodesignerswalkintoabar.com for full episode notes and visuals, the latest blog content, and to sign up for our newsletter.
Follow us on social media. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Find the links on our website or search using the phrase Two Designers Walk Into a Bar.
Most importantly, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people like you find podcasts like this.
And tell a friend about us. Send them a link to our podcast from your listening platform of choice.
And, if you're inclined, buy our merchandise. Stickers, coasters, magnets, t-shirts. We're designers. We make good stuff, and it helps support the show.
Get in touch. Use the contact form on our website or send an email to hello@twodesignerswalkintoabar.com.
We read every message we get. Honest.
And we're available for speaking gigs. Email us to learn more.
Okay, now, back to the bar. So welcome back, everybody. And Elliot, I have a question for you.
Okay, shoot.
When last we left, we were talking about things like the global awareness that artists and musicians and people, they were getting more exposed to different cultures, political problems, economies, and that drove the music and made it sort of question the traditional. How do you think that idea showed up in visual design?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. This is a design podcast, isn't it?
Well, we talked about designing music for the first part. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that just like the music itself, it was a period of transition visually. I mean, you have people making posters and album covers who are classically trained, mm-hmm. right? And quote unquote, mm-hmm. to use your air quotes, they knew the rules, right? Mm-hmm. But then you also had these DIY outsiders, some of these folks you had been talking about earlier. So they were coming in and they were really sort of mixing stuff up, right? These were untrained mm-hmm. designers or their friends who were mm-hmm. making t-shirts and flyers and album art and whatever to support the bands, right? Mm-hmm. So all of this mm-hmm. stuff is being put together by hand. And this is, you know, folks, this is pre-Macintosh, pre-1984, so pre-desktop publishing. And so you had the same handful of colors being used and shapes mm-hmm. and patterns, mm-hmm. typefaces, high contrast photos that were really more photo illustrations, right? Because they mm-hmm. were filtered so much so they could be easy to reproduce. And so stuff was hitting the ceiling visually, I think, given what was available at the time mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. people to use. I mean, what do you think about?
I think of plastic about that time.
Okay, well, you know, if people say that's the future, I think I heard that in a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so when you had mentioned this topic to me originally, when you said that you wanted to do this, you know, I sniffed around a little bit, you know, and this was soon after I'd shared that documentary with you and you got excited. And so I started doing a little bit of homework, and there's a great article in AIGA, so that's a professional design organization for folks who may not know what that is. And they have a website called Eye on Design, and they have this article called New Wave Graphics Are the Most Influential Designs You've Probably Ignored. And this is an article written by Emily Gosling, and she says that, quote, New Wave melded its influences into more than the sum of its parts, transforming niche visual reference points and repurposing them in a way that still feels decidedly cult, right? Yet with one eye firmly on the realm of pop culture. And we'll add a link to this article to our episode page. But, you know, it's kind of funny, like a quick takeaway I had from that is when you think of remix culture now and the internet and memes and everything like that, like in a lot of ways we have DIY that's happening now, and it's through Canva and it's on YouTube or TikTok or whatever, right? So like everything, the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? And history just repeats itself. So earlier you were talking about the scene forming. You mentioned a second factor that led to New Wave, right? Technology. We were just talking about technology. So unpack that for us.
Yeah, that's obviously a big one, because the first thing we were exposed to more, so it allowed our brains to sort of stretch. And at the same time, technology, you mentioned the Macs coming on in 1984, technology was expanding our capabilities. But by the 1980s, let's speak specifically about synthesizers, because I think of that mostly when I think of New Wave.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a reason why.
Yeah.
Because they were becoming more widespread. And not to get overly musical wonky here, but to get wonky for a second, earlier synthesizers were monophonic, which means they only played one note at a time. And early polyphonic synthesizers, like the Prophet 5, released in 1978, had five-voice polyphony.
You know, I don't know what you're saying, Professor, but it sounds important.
All right, I'll break it down. Musicians no longer had to fiddle with cables and twist knobs to get a sound. The Prophet 5 could save sound patches, which elevated synthesizers from these sort of unpredictable beep-bop-boops to producing standard reproducible sounds that could then be layered and precise.
Yeah, kind of an early form of sampling, I guess, right? So,
kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So you're creating more complexity, like you talked about earlier, with different rhythms and things like that. All these different influences could be fed into these machines and saved or looped or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah. And according to Music Radar, the Prophet 5 changed the world and became a market leader and industry standard. And I would say virtually every sound in a song that you heard of that period that wasn't a guitar was coming from a Prophet 5. And it wasn't long before other makers joined in, of course. New sounds were only limited by the imagination of the musicians. That's kind of where we are still today. It's certainly progressed some, but we haven't had a radical change, because at that time was when technology really exploded.
Okay, so can we thank the 80s for autotune, just like we can thank Peter Frampton for the talk box? All right. Yeah. Well, maybe I'm going out on a limb here. Okay. I think it's easy to figure out, to sort of see the role technology had on visuals as well, right? Like we were just talking about.
Yeah.
So the New Wave look sort of prefigured the Mac by a few years, as I mentioned a second ago. And everything looked like it was pulled from video screens, but it was funny because it was really sort of, just like the first Macs were only in black and white, it felt like a lot of these images were almost black and white stills, and then it was hand-tinted with sort of these vibrant, almost primary colors.
Yeah, good observation, and you led right into my last factor, which was that the New Wave picked up on the DIY ethos, as I said, from the punk era, and then it was rehashed from 1950s and 1960s music, and new wave was like an explosion of 50s rock and roll all over again, just, you know, more plastic.
Okay, you keep bringing up this word plastic.
What is it about plastic?
Yeah, well, yeah, what's this guy's obsession with plastic? I mean, I know you love Tupperware and everything, but could you could you unpack this maybe a little bit for me
and for our listeners? All right, so plastic. If you think about punk was ragged, you saw sort of the rough edges of everything. That was the beauty of it. In new wave, everything had this gloss and this sheen about it. It was sharp and it was poppy. So here's an example that you probably know that demonstrates the DIY ethos that caught on. You remember the song My Sharona from the Knack?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Okay. So the song sounded like a garage band, definitely not overlayered in production, but still really poppy. In the songwriter's obit that appeared in the New York Times, it said he claimed the song was written in 15 minutes and then recorded in 15 minutes.
So half hour's worth of work. Very DIY.
Yeah, right. And yeah, and you're set for life. Yeah. But it sounded so different. It was both a throwback and it was fresh. And it happened to be Billboard magazine's number one single of 1979. So as record companies do, and other musicians do, they paid attention. Uh-huh. So that success, combined with new wave albums being much cheaper to produce, gave that slumping record industry of the late 70s a boost, and prompting companies, again, as I said earlier, to sign slews of new wave groups.
Okay, and boom, we have a bona fide movement suddenly, right?
Yep, yep.
You know, related to that, if ever a movement was televised, I would say new wave was all right there in its glorious, vibrant colors on MTV in the early 80s, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's not a coincidence that those things came along at the same time. And
yeah, agreed.
I mean, MTV may be the TV channel, I would say, that's had the single biggest influence on pop culture. Graphics mm-hmm. came alive. New techniques were explored. Video came into its own. I mean, if you think about it, MTV was really the first example of liquid branding, right? Like the first motion-based brand, and that was like the early 80s. So we'll talk more about the influence of MTV in our next episode. I don't want to jump too far ahead here.
Cool. Yeah. All right. I'll be looking forward to that because, you know, that was a really special time. And again, I think I was 18 then. You were still a little young, but we would sit around all day watching MTV.
Oh, yeah.
And it was an interesting and exciting time in the creative world. And talking about all this new wave stuff really does take me back to my teens and my college days, and I really miss it.
Well, good. How about you relive your college memories and head back over to the bar, freshman, and you can get us a few more drinks, because I'm missing one of those right now.
I should have seen that one coming, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I'm hazing you.
All right. Now, this has been fun, and I look forward to the next one as we dig further into New Wave.
Yeah, I enjoyed this trip down memory lane.
Bye, everybody.
So, Jim, we got a problem with our podcast.
Right. Nobody says it correctly.
No. Some people say how to fix it.
Or how do you fix it?
But think of it like this. Whatever the problem, we're in this together.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Yeah. How do we fix it? The Solutions Show. From the political to the personal.
Practical ideas for creative listeners.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Ideas that work.
That's your radio voice, Richard.
Oh, well, I know.
I love it. I couldn't do it to save my life.
Two Designers Walk Into a Bar is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network.
For more information about our show or to discover more podcasts you'll enjoy, visit evergreenpodcasts.com.